Okay. So I knew that if I waited about a week or so, we would have some groundbreaking news in the world of college athletics, not even just college football, but college athletics as a whole. And sure enough, what happens late Friday night? The NCAA house settlement, you know, the thing that we've been talking about for months and months and months, it seems like, was finally approved. I have thoughts. I'm certainly going to get tonight. In fact, it's going to take up a large majority of the show tonight. The NCAA versus Michigan news never really stops. There's more news, actually, on that front. I'm going to get into that as well. There were some very notable people that had some strong opinions on the 5+11 playoff format that is gaining traction. I'm going to address that, as well as ESPN decided to release their Football Power Index Top 25, and as you can only imagine, that received quite a reaction from the internet. I will get to that and much more. Welcome into the Air Raid with Parker Kelly on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game across the Game Nashville Sports Network. If you haven't already, please make sure that you subscribe to the Game Nashville podcast. And I'm told that's wherever you get your podcast, whether that be Apple, Spotify. Isn't there like an Amazon audiobook? Something, you know, it's everywhere. Please make sure that you're subscribed to the Game Nashville. You'll never miss an episode of the Air Raid with Parker Kelly. And you'll also get access to our other great podcasts that we have here going on at the station. And please give me a follow on the socials. I'm at Parker_Kelly10. Let's get into this because I'm getting ready to go to CMA Fest for the final night of the week in downtown Nashville. So but first I gotta give you the college football news because that's the most important thing right now, the most pressing matter that we have on our hands. Okay, so the NCAA house settlement was approved on Friday night. What this does is it permits schools to begin paying athletes directly. Now, let me be very clear. The schools will be paying the athletes in addition to the scholarships that the athletes are already receiving, plus any other benefits that the athletes get. And then they get a ton of benefits nowadays. The NCAA will also pay back nearly $2.8 billion in back damages over the last 10 years to athletes who competed in any college sport from 2016 to the present day. So not only are schools going to begin paying their athletes, but the NCAA is having to work retroactively to pay back athletes all the way back to 2016 because they missed out on NIL because it wasn't approved until July of 2021. One more thing that this house settlement does, it establishes a salary cap of roughly $20.5 million starting this fiscal year, 2025-2026, and that cap will continue to increase every year during a decade-long deal that we have this house settlement. So my reaction to this, I have several thoughts on this, but I was reading through all this. I was looking at all the logistics. College athletes have really never had it better than what they have right now. Think about it. College athletes, I'm sure they've, for a long time, even before NIL was introduced, I'm sure that they wanted to get paid. But they weren't the ones on the forefront, on the front lines of this, pushing for NIL. It was more so the adults in the room. But college athletes get to benefit off of this because they get to make money. And now, in addition to the NIL that they receive, they also get a chunk of money from the school that will allow them to directly pay their athletes. Now, obviously, it's $20.5 million, so it's not an eternal well of cash, right? That the schools have to be smart in how they divvy up the money, and I'm sure a large chunk of it is going to go to the football team and the men's basketball team. I'm sure that since those are the top two sports in terms of most revenue, I'm sure that they're going to get a large chunk of this. But I seriously also think that this house settlement being approved is as big of a deal as when NIL was introduced in the first place, because, and I'm just going to get into this. So one of my colleagues here at 102.5 The Game, Jared Stillman, was talking about this on his show on Thursday. Jared believes that there is a swath of people out there who believe that NIL and transfer portal have ruined college athletics. And my stance on this is I don't believe that the sport is ruined. I use the famous Rome analogy every time I talk about this. You know, the saying that Rome wasn't built in a day, well, neither was college football. College football is a very resilient sport. That's why it is able to thrive, even though all this chaos is going on behind the scenes. I filled in as a guest on Forrest Company, our weekend show on Saturday, and I brought up this analogy. You take the Georgia-Alabama game that was played last year, one of the best games of the college football season. Towards the end of that game, when things are really getting tight, you know, when Georgia started to make a comeback, they even took the lead at one point. As you were sitting there watching the end of that game, were you thinking to yourself, I wonder how much Georgia's left tackle is making in NIL? I wonder who is transferred from whatever team to Georgia or whatever team to Alabama. You're not thinking about that. Why? Because that game and how tight it got towards the end had your full attention. So as long as we can capture that feeling and bottle that up and maintain that feel each Saturday in the fall, college sports are not ruined. Now, that doesn't mean that we can allow whatever we want as far as NIL and transfer portal is concerned, because I believe that that has taken a little bit of a toll on the sport. Again, the sport isn't ruined. In fact, it's far from ruined, but it's not ruined. So NIL and transfer portal, yes, it may have peeled back a layer of the sport. And while, if unregulated, I believe some of these things can be very detrimental to the sport, I'm very optimistic about this house settlement. Why? Because someone is actually doing something. Now, if you would have asked me 5 to 10 years ago if I would have wanted government intervention in college athletics, I would have scoffed. I would have laughed at you. But where we are in the sport, or where we were, and even still are to some extent, there's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of nebulous. There's a lot of not really knowing what's going on. Somebody needed to take the reins, and clearly the NCAA wasn't doing it. So that leaves me very optimistic about this house settlement because, like I said, somebody is actually stepping up and doing something. Now, I will say, the legal drama is far from over. I mean, the legal drama is not going to stop because since this is so new, this house settlement, there are still going to be questions about whether athletes should be considered employees. That's been a big conversation in recent years. Collective bargaining agreements, are we going to get that in college athletics? Player unions? The list goes on and on and on. So the legal aspect is really not entirely solved. And also, too, I want to bring up another interesting aspect of all of this. The power conferences, they actually came to an agreement, and they're launching a new enforcement organization called the College Sports Commission Now, this College Sports Commission, aka the CSC, their job is going to be to monitor payments that come from schools and boosters to athletes. That responsibility used to belong to the NCAA, but since they can't take a piss without getting the front of their pants wet, they have been, the NCAA has been further weakened than what they previously were. Now, former MLB executive Brian Seeley, he has been named the CEO of the College Sports Commission. He brings a ton of investigative experience in both the private sector and professional sports. I went and I looked at his resume last night, and it was very impressive. So that was what these power conference commissioners hoped for in terms of hiring a CEO, was a guy like Seeley who had all this. I mean, I encourage you to go look up his resume because it is impressive. But he has all this investigative experience, so it's really, really encouraging to know that this is the guy that's going to be running the CSC and monitoring these NIL deals that will be distributed to the athletes from the school and from boosters and so on and so forth. Another aspect that I wanted to bring up is there is an accounting firm called, I'm going to try to pronounce this right. I'm not entirely sure if I'm getting the pronunciation correct. Deloitte, that's a tough word for me to say. But they have been lined up, them and LBI Software have been lined up to handle a salary cap management and to manage a clearinghouse for NIL. This clearinghouse will be known as NIL Go. I've touched on this very briefly in a previous show, but they're going to basically, NIL Go will be used to verify whether deals between athletes and boosters or other associated entities are for valid business purposes rather than some recruiting incentive. I'm encouraged by the guy they hired to monitor all this, considering his background in investigation. And there are also, from what I've been reading, for the schools that violate or tamper, there's going to be a stiff penalty. It's not just going to be a little slap on the wrist, right? I've been saying for a long time that college athletics as a whole, if we're looking big picture here, cannot advance in a positive direction if at the 11th hour of every single day, something new is being taken to court. So that's the first step here, is when everything stops going to court, then I believe we can advance. But there are going to be some legal challenges, again, because this is so new. And also, any NIL deal worth over $600 has to go through this clearinghouse, basically to determine fair market value for athletes. My question is, how do you determine what the market value is? I believe if a kid gets an NIL deal, goes through the clearinghouse, NIL Go determines that the NIL deal is not fair market value, well, how is that determined? So that's kind of a question that I have regarding all this. But overall, I'm fairly optimistic because, again, action is being taken and it's something tangible that we can we can read about, that this was approved by Judge Claudia Wilkin, who we've mentioned on the show before. And we're not just dealing with hypotheticals anymore. So I certainly think that this is a step in a positive direction. Now, we're going to get into something else that was going on in the courtroom and not actually on the football field. That is the NCAA versus Michigan. Yes, I know. The news continues to flow. There is more Michigan versus NCAA news. Who could have guessed? Over the weekend, Michigan wrapped up a two-day hearing before the NCAA's Committee on Infractions. They're in charge of examining potential punishments for impermissible scouting and sign stealing. which was orchestrated by none other than the infamous Connor Stallions. Michigan has chosen not to comment on the case until a final resolution has been decided, which isn't likely to come until later this summer or fall, a final decision on what Michigan's final punishment will be. Now, Michigan is guilty of 11 recruiting violations, 6 level 1, which are the most serious. Now, I've been very staunch in my opinion from the start that I don't believe, until conclusive evidence comes out that proves otherwise, I don't believe that any of the sign stealing and yada, yada, yada had anything to do with Michigan's national championship run in 2023. Now, are they guilty? Absolutely. Because, I mean, all this stuff is coming out, and we've known a lot of this for a while. They had to be guilty. Had to be. To some extent, had to be. But most of, or a fair amount of it, came out before the 2023 season. So the Big Ten, the NCAA, they all knew about this before Michigan started their 2023 season. And if you remember, Jim Harbaugh was suspended at the start of the season, and then he was suspended at the end of the season. So they basically handicapped Michigan, and yet Michigan still went out and won every game that they played. So, and Connor Stallions was gone by this point as well, so he really had nothing to do with it. And if you, what I'm talking about is what I saw on the field. Michigan, that was probably the most talented roster in the country if you consider all the draft picks that they had the following year. And even, you know, this year, guys like Mason Graham and Kenneth Grant and Will Johnson, guys like that, that was a very talented team. And really all you had to do was just watch that team and how they played. That team was very talented, and I think Michigan was, that staff was one of the better developing of players staffs in the entire country. So I don't think Connor Stallions had anything to do with their national championship run in 2023, and I've stood by that for a while. So Michigan self-imposed a suspension on Sherrone Moore for weeks 3 and weeks 4 of the 2025 season after he deleted a thread of 52 text messages with Connor Stallions. So basically, by Michigan self-imposing a suspension on Sherrone Moore for those weeks, ironically, he got to pick which weeks he wanted to be suspended for, which really isn't much of a suspension as it is a vacation. He still gets to coach in the Oklahoma game in week 2, which is Sherrone Moore's alma mater. So obviously you can understand why he'd want to coach in that game. But basically they're hoping that by self-imposing this punishment, the NCAA sees that they're, hey, you know, we're punishing our coach. And they're hoping that no further action is taken and that there is no further punishment to be handed out. I will say this about the whole Sherrone Moore deleting 52 text messages. Even if the text messages were completely harmless, even if they were, and they very well could have been, isn't it still a little suspicious that you're deleting a text thread between the guy who's catching all this heat in the first place? It's still very suspicious. Even if the text messages mean absolutely nothing, it's still suspicious. So I think that that's something that we can all agree on. But hey, look, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a more severe punishment to be handed out. But to be honest, I'm ready to be done talking about this because I want to talk about real football, not just the stuff that's going on in the courtroom. And with that being said, I will transition. So I talked about the playoff model and what that's going to look like going forward. Now, obviously, for this upcoming season, it is still the 12-team format, but it's just going to be straight seeding. Conference champs will still be included in the playoffs, the main difference being it's straight seeding, based off of the committee's final rankings at the end of the season. So what it'll look like going forward, we don't quite yet know. But we do know that the SEC and the Big Ten take control starting in 2026. Now, it has been reported by Pete Thamel, Ross Dellinger, a ton of the best reporters in the business, Heather Dinage, that the 5 plus 11 model is gaining traction. The other models that we have seen thrown out there, and you can do several different number variances with this, but we have heard that the SEC and the Big Ten have pushed for 4 automatic bids each, the ACC and the Big 12 getting 2, and then you could do, depending on if you want 4 or 16, you can do 1 at large, 2 at large, however many, and then Notre Dame also gets kind of a safety net as they would get included in the playoff if their record was good enough. So, but the 5 plus 11 model is gaining traction. And let me tell you, it's a trap. It is a trap. I laid out the numbers for you on the last show that over the last 10 playoffs, if we did a 5 plus 11 model straight seeding, the Big Ten on average would have about 5, and so would the SEC. Last year, if we would have done a 5 plus 11 model, you know how many teams the SEC would have gotten? 6. You know how many the Big 12 would have gotten? 1. And that just would have been Arizona State. So, in my opinion, the Big 12 and the ACC should want the 4-4-2-2-1-1 model, which would be the 4 automatic bids for the SEC and Big Ten, respectively, the 2 automatic bids for the Big 12 and the ACC, respectively. Then you get 1 at-large bid and 1 for the highest-ranked Group of 5 champion. Now, that's my preferred model. But regardless of what model you want, regardless of what model I want, the Big 12 and the ACC should want automatic bids. That's what they should want. Now, if you would have asked me about this even last year, oh my gosh, I don't know what road I would have went down. You know I'm one of the last people that wanted expansion for this playoff. But there's no putting the toothpaste back in the tube. We're here right now. So if it were up to me, I'd go back to the 4, maybe even a 16 playoff or the BCS even. But we're here now. No putting the toothpaste back in the tube. We just got to deal with what we're dealing with. Now, I highly recommend you go listen to what Joel Klatt over at Fox Sports had to say about this, because he did on his last podcast that was released last week, he berated this idea of a 5 plus 11 model. I mean, absolutely berated it. Now, him and I both have a ton of respect for Big 12 Commissioner Brett Yormark. I do not believe he's an idiot. I believe sometimes smart people say very casual things. Often, it's very rare that casual fans say something smart. In this case, I believe it is the first thing. Brett Yormark, I believe, is a very smart individual who happens to believe in something very casual. Here's the thing. If you take that 5 plus 11 model and you incorporate it into last year's playoff, again, Arizona State's the only team that makes it in from the Big 12. In this idea of the 4-4-2-2-1-1 model, you're automatically guaranteed 2 teams from your conference in, which is more than you got last year. And if you're wanting fairness, if you're wanting to flatten the curve of who really runs the sport in college football, this is your best shot. Because if you want that 5 plus 11 model, you're only guaranteed 1 Big 12 team in. If you're the ACC, you're only guaranteed 1 ACC team. The SEC and the Big Ten could take up the rest of those spots for all I know. So if you're taking this 5 plus 11 model, you're giving the SEC and you're giving the Big Ten exactly what they want. You're helping their case. And if you're the SEC, We've all seen the reports of them wanting the four auto bids. But I've also seen that the SEC has backed this idea as well because they know that they will get potentially six teams in the playoff. So the SEC, Greg Sankey's come out and said that they have not publicly supported a model. But if they have shown some support for this, and they've shown some support for the 4-4-2-2-1-1, and regardless of what they do, they seem to get backlash from any and everybody. So my question to those people that are hating on the SEC for supporting the 5-plus-11 model, what else do you want them to do? Because if they propose the 4-4-2-2-1-1 and get four auto bids from the conference, everyone comes out of their corners and says, oh, look at the SEC being greedy again. Well, then if they support the 5-plus-11 model, those people say the exact same thing. What do you want the SEC to do? What do you want them to do? So I'm not really going to talk more about the playoff because I talked about it in great detail in the last show, but those are some thoughts that I have regarding the 5-plus-11 model. I think it's a complete trap and I wouldn't do it. Okay, so ESPN recently released their Football Power Index, also known as FPI. ESPN released their ESPN FPI Top 25. I have my thoughts on it. I'm going to get into that right now. So first, before I do, let me go ahead and go through the list, okay? So number one, Texas. Number two, Georgia. Number three, Alabama. Number four, Ohio State. Number five, Penn State. Number six, Oregon. Number seven, Notre Dame. Number eight, Texas A&M. Number nine, Miami. And number 10, Tennessee. That is the top 10 in ESPN's FPI Top 25. Now we'll go 11 through the rest. So 11, Clemson. Number 12, LSU. Number 13, Ole Miss. Number 14, Auburn. Number 15, South Carolina. Number 16, Oklahoma. Number 17, Michigan. Number 18, Florida. Number 19, USC. Number 20, SMU. Number 21, Kansas State. Number 22, Arkansas. Number 23, Missouri. 24, Arizona State. And 25, Nebraska. If we're breaking it down by conference, there are 13 members from the SEC and ESPN's FPI Top 25. The SEC bias crowd is probably going to have a heyday with that. They already have. There are six teams from the Big Ten, three from the ACC, two from the Big 12, and Notre Dame. Now, it is important to remember, I don't know exactly how ESPN calculates this Top 25, but remember that these are not rankings. It is a Football Power Index rating. So this is not how the top 25 is going to look when it's released before the season starts. However, I do have my issues with it. So my biggest one is Texas A&M. They are number eight on this list. I am high on Texas A&M because I'm high on Mike Elko. He is a no bullcrap type of coach. He does not tolerate it. He got the most out of his roster when he was the head coach at Duke. Duke is not exactly a football power, but yet he was able to lead Duke to a pretty good degree of success. And he was able to do it with a much less talented overall roster. And also, Mike Elko spent time as the defensive coordinator at Texas A&M before he took the head coaching job at Duke. And now he's back in College Station. So he already has familiarity with the program. But I'm really high on Mike Elko. I believe he's going to have a lot of success in College Station. I believe Texas A&M has always been a sleeping giant in football, where they've always had the talent in the state. They're in Texas, which is one of the high school football state capitals, you know? So they're not exactly hurting for talent in the state. And they're also not hurting for money. They have plenty of boosters in College Station. They have plenty of NIL funds to go around. So if Texas A&M were to ever reach elite to even great level status, I believe Texas A&M is a sleeping giant in the sport. However, I do not believe that they're quite there yet. I believe they are taking steps in the right direction to get there, but they're not there yet. Now, this roster is certainly very capable of making some noise this year. I believe the defense is going to be very, very good under Mike Elko. I believe that Texas A&M legit has a chance to have one of the best rushing attacks in the SEC and maybe even in the country. They have a three-headed monster at running back. Marcel Reed is back for his second year as the starter. I'd like to see him progress more as a passer, you know, what he can do in the run game. But as for right now, I think Texas A&M is a little high for my liking. Miami is at number 9. They are 2 spots above Clemson, their ACC counterpart. I had Clemson as the 3rd ranked team in my post-spring top 25. I'm very high on Clemson. I think they're a legit national title contender this year. So I don't like that Miami is above Clemson to start. I do think Miami, you know, they got quarterback Carson Beck from Georgia. While Carson Beck may not be Cam Ward, I still think Carson Beck is very, very, very good. I still have a lot of questions about the defense. Now, Miami went out and they got the defensive coordinator from Minnesota and Corey Heatherman. So I'm interested to see how much that helps out their defense. But I believe that Mario Cristobal has Miami trending in the right direction. But I don't like them above Clemson to start. Auburn at 14. Bold. It's very, very bold. Now, Auburn does have a talented roster. And I still have not sold my stock on Jackson Arnold, who is the quarterback at Auburn by way of Oklahoma. If he can just cut down on the turnovers, which have been an issue for him over the last 2 years, I think Jackson Arnold can be a very good quarterback. But he does have to cut down on the turnovers. Auburn has a very talented roster. The last 2 seasons you wouldn't know based on their record, but they have a very talented roster, but I still think 14 is very, very high. All right. 2 more issues that I have with this Football Power Index top 25. Arkansas at 22. To be honest, I really don't understand this one because I watched Arkansas a lot last year. And they didn't really upgrade at a lot of positions other than quarterback. I mean, Talen Green is a pretty good quarterback. But they didn't really upgrade at many positions throughout the roster. So if they didn't upgrade and they went, 7-6 last year, I believe was the record. I just don't understand that one. And the last one, Arizona State at 24. I'm very high on Arizona State. I think this is way too low. And I think that speaks for itself. They have the 2nd most returning production in the country. That 79% of last year's roster is returning to this year's team. So I really like Arizona State. Now, I know that this isn't the ranking that is going to be put out before the season, but that's just some quick issues that I have with ESPN's FPI Top 25. Okay. Ryan Williams, the wide receiver at Alabama, made some recent comments about Vanderbilt. So, as we all know, Vanderbilt upset Alabama, which was one of the biggest upsets of last year's regular season. So John Gruden, who is now doing some work with Barstool Sports, I guess he had Ryan Williams on one of his various shows, podcasts, whatever. He asked him about the Vandy game last year. And, you know, Ryan Williams, you know, acknowledges, yeah, that, you know, that happened. But he mentioned that Bama, and I'm not, you know, quoting Ryan Williams word for word, so don't take this out of context. But Ryan Williams said that this year, Bama was going to take a sledgehammer to an ant. I mentioned Jared Stillman earlier in this podcast. Jared talked about this on his show, and he thinks that because Ryan Williams made this comment, that this has something to do with Kalen Boer not being the guy at Alabama. A lot of people think that because Ryan Williams said this, they think, oh, this would never happen under Nick Saban. You may be right about that. But Kalen DeBoer is not Nick Saban. That's not breaking any news here. But he also doesn't have to be Nick Saban. I have no worries about Kalen DeBoer being the guy to Alabama. He's a winner. He's won everywhere he's gone, all the way back to Sioux Falls at the NAIA level, when he was the offensive coordinator at Indiana with Michael Penix, to when he was the head coach at Washington. I know Alabama went 9-4 last year, and I know if you're an Alabama fan, you're not used to 9-4. I understand how that could be a disappointment. Here's the thing, though, about college athletics and the way that they are nowadays. When head coaches leave, typically players leave to go to other schools or to maybe even follow that coach. So when Nick Saban retired, it was a bombshell to the college football community. It was a bombshell to the sports community in general. But when Kalen DeBoer took the job, obviously you have your people that are going to either decommit from the current recruiting class, or you have players that are going to transfer. The list goes on. So obviously it was year one for Kalen DeBoer, and he hadn't necessarily put all of his fingerprints on the program yet. It's year two now for Kalen DeBoer. And those guys that are on the team, those veterans that are on the team in Alabama, they had three different opportunities to leave, as there were three portal cycles that happened between when Kalen DeBoer took the job at Alabama to today. So the guys that stayed throughout all of that are truly Kalen DeBoer's guys. And not to mention the guys that have been recruited by Kalen DeBoer that are coming in for this upcoming season. Those are Kalen DeBoer's guys as well. Kalen DeBoer had to handle last year in a way that he didn't, because there was a lot of talent that left when Nick Saban retired. So he had to coach in a way in which more players would not hit the exit door, if that makes sense. This year, now that, you know, Kalen DeBoer's had 1 year under his belt, we've talked about the guys that had opportunities to leave but didn't, the guys that have been recruited by Kalen DeBoer, the kid gloves are off. Now it is Kalen DeBoer's program, and he has a chance to put more of his fingerprints on the program in Alabama. So I'm very confident in the direction of the Crimson Tide going forward. I have no worries about Kalen DeBoer at Alabama. And we got to remember, guys, it was year one. There has to be an adjustment period. I mean, he's literally following the greatest of all time. And in today's age of college athletics, where players transfer left and right, even at Alabama, we got to be gracious. Got to be gracious with Kalen DeBoer. Now, some sad news that came out of Eugene, Oregon this past weekend, and this is tragic. Evan Stewart, wide receiver, suffers a knee injury that is expected to impact his availability during 2025. Now, this is potentially season ending. However, we don't know the extent of the injury quite yet, but it's not very promising. This is a huge, huge blow to the Ducks. Evan Stewart caught 48 passes for 613 yards and 5 touchdowns. He was expected to be wide receiver one this year, transferred from Texas A&M, a former 5-star guy. Evan Stewart was a very talented receiver. Now, to be fair, we don't know how serious this is, but again, not looking very promising, so it's a huge blow to Oregon's wide receiver room. Now, I'm in the process of doing a season preview for a select team each episode of this podcast until we get to the regular season. I wanted to do one for Oregon because it just seems right, you know, considering what just happened with Evan Stewart. Now, there is some good news for Oregon. They return wideouts Justius Lowe, who is a former five-star recruit, Gary Bryant Jr., who was a transfer from USC 2 seasons ago, Malik Benson, who came in to Eugene from Florida State. They also have the number one overall wide receiver recruit from the 2025 class in DeCorian Moore, who is I believe he's a day one starter anywhere that he goes. So there's still some talent on the roster. There's still some talent in the wide receiver room, even without Evan Stewart. Now, as far as the quarterback, we all expect it to be Dante Moore. Now, Dan Lanning has not come out and announced that Dante Moore is going to be the starter, but we all just expect it. Austin Novosad, who is a sophomore, is also in the running. Kenyon Sadiq returns at tight end. He was in a pretty crowded wide receiver room last year with Terrence Ferguson, who is a second-round pick to the Los Angeles Rams. Also, Patrick Herbert, who was the brother of Chargers quarterback Justin Herbert. He was also a tight end on the team last year. He's no longer on the roster as he's graduated. So Kenyon Sadiq returns, and he's expected to be tight end one. He was the most athletic tight end by far on the roster last year. He had 2 touchdowns in the Big Ten championship game versus Penn State. I was in attendance for that game. I literally saw him hurdle a defender on his way into the end zone. This dude is a genetic freak. So that's huge for Oregon. So they still have a lot of great pass catchers. Their offensive line had to be retooled a little bit. They bring in offensive tackle Isaiah World from Nevada, who is the number one overall offensive tackle in the portal. They believe he could be a first-round draft pick next year, maybe even a top 10 pick. They bring in offensive tackle Alex Harkey from Texas State, guard Emmanuel Pregnon from USC. Oregon had both of their left tackle in Josh Connerly and right tackle Johnny Cornelius. We're both drafted in the past NFL draft. So they had to retool their offensive line a little bit. They do so by going and getting 3 guys out of the portal. If that line can gel, I expect it to be very good. Running back Makai Hughes, who came to Oregon via the portal by way of Tulane, he had over 1,400 rushing yards last season with 15 touchdowns. Excuse me. Very dynamic back. And fun fact, he's actually the cousin of corner Naeem Offord, who was a 5-star cornerback that committed to Oregon in this past class. That's his cousin. So that's just a pretty cool fun fact. I expect the defense to be really good once again. They go out and they got safety Dylan Thieneman, who is the number one safety in the portal from Purdue. Cornerback Theron Johnson from Northwestern. Linebacker Bryce Betcher returns, as well as linebackers Devin Jackson and Mateo Uyunglele. Safety Kingston Lopa. So they have some guys that are returning on defense, and they also went out and got some dudes in the portal as well that could really, really help this defense. And also, not to mention, they went out and they got defensive tackle Bear Alexander, who's a very well-known name, as he tries to revive his career at Oregon. He was at Georgia and at USC. A lot of you know who Bear Alexander is. Now, I wanted to look at the 2025 schedule for Oregon because there are some really intriguing games. So week 5, they go to Penn State. Now, that game time was announced. It'll kick off at 6:30 p.m. It is the annual whiteout game for Penn State. So I have that one circled on my calendar. I would personally love to go. Oregon has a bye week, and then they host Indiana. So depending on what Indiana is able to do this year, I think that one could be very intriguing. that Oregon is at Iowa on November 8th. Here's another one that I have circled on my calendar. USC. USC comes to town on November 22nd. An old Pac-12 rivalry, RIP. USC and Oregon, they go after a lot of the same recruits. Go after a lot of the same guys in the portal. They were a rivalry. I still think that they're a rivalry even now in the Big Ten. I think USC can be a very improved team this year as well. So I have that game circled on my calendar, and then obviously they end the year at Washington, which is also a really big rivalry as well. So got some pretty tough games on the roster. Now, as of right now, the over-under win total for Oregon is 10.5, according to FanDuel. Now, if we're looking at the rest of the odds, Oregon has the fifth highest odds, according to ESPN Bet, of winning the national championship. Excuse me, it's tied for fourth. So they're tied with Penn State at plus 750 odds to win the national championship. In terms of winning the Big Ten, they're also tied with Penn State for winning the Big Ten at plus 275. Ohio State is the favorite at plus 200. I really think Oregon can have another great year under Dan Lanning in year number four for him. I know success doesn't always carry over from year to year, but I still think that Oregon has enough returning talent and talent that they've brought in. I'm very excited to see how Dante Moore is able to perform this year. I think Oregon, despite those tricky games, I still think they have a very workable schedule. I'm very excited to see how Oregon is able to perform this year. Should be a very fun season, and man, we are closer. We're getting closer and closer and closer to the start of the college football season. Very, very excited. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Air Raid with Parker Kelly here on the Game Nashville Sports Network. Remember to subscribe to the Game Nashville. You'll never miss an episode, as well as follow me on the socials. I'm at Parker_Kelly10. I have another episode here for you shortly. In the meantime, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.